from Tukito LLC. It's Keto Woman Podcast with Daisy Brackenhall.
Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight, after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. Keto has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman Podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs to 20 grams or less per day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein, scale to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guest each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history and so have access to the bigger picture. This week's extraordinary woman is Amy Chirico. Amy is a pediatric critical care medicine doctor in northern New Jersey, where she lives with her husband and two toddler daughters. Her weight struggles began at an early age, and she spent years yo-yo dieting and searching for a sustainable plan to lose and maintain her weight. She feels that keto, along with active work on her mindset and perspective, are the solutions for which she's been searching all along and have benefited her in so many ways beyond weight loss. Her goals now include spreading the word about the benefits and myths about keto to her colleagues in the medical community, her patients and their families when possible, and anyone else who will listen, and providing support to others getting started or maintaining their keto way of eating. I was lucky to catch a slot in Amy's very busy schedule. What a busy life she leads. She has a lot of interesting ideas to share, and I hope you enjoy hearing about them as much as I did. Welcome, Amy, to the Keto Woman Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Daisy. Thanks for having me.
Now, I happen to know, because we just had a little chat before we started, that you're a little bit tired and need your bed. Why is that?
I'm a little tired because I just finished working a 24-hour shift as a pediatric intensive care unit doctor.
That sounds pretty full on.
It is. Yesterday's wasn't so busy, but there are days.
And how long have you been doing that?
So I finished actually my pediatrics residency in 2015. And then I did my pediatric intensive care fellowship. Both of them I did in New York City at Columbia. I finished that in June. And I started this job, my first kind of big girl attending job, just a few weeks ago. So it's been an exciting time.
Wow. Yeah, a bit of a whirlwind.
Yeah.
And you've got two children yourself, haven't you? So it must be difficult juggling work, kids, sleep.
Yeah, it is. I had my older daughter who's four when I was a pediatrics resident. So that was difficult. I went back to work when she was about 7 weeks old. So I learned to kind of juggle busy work and having a newborn pretty quickly. And then I had my second daughter, who's now 20 months old, in the middle of my pediatric critical care fellowship. So same kind of thing, busy
wow.
training.
I bet that sounds like a challenge and a half.
Luckily, I have a very helpful and supportive husband who does a lot with the kids. So, and my mother lives just like half a mile away, so she helps us out a lot.
Oh, that is handy.
Yeah.
Yes, I bet you rely on that family support a lot.
Definitely.
Good to have it. So tell me a bit about you, about your background, what led you to start looking at dietary changes and find keto in the first place?
So in terms of looking for dietary changes, I'd say that's something I've been doing for my entire life, probably for the last 20 plus years.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
I would say I started noticing that I had weight to lose, or started thinking about my weight even as early as a preteen, kind of young teenager. I think at that time, probably my weight struggle started with a whole culmination of things like puberty, and I had some hip surgeries between the ages of 11 and 13, which rendered me a little immobile, like post-op, for a few months at a time. I think that didn't help. And then right around that time, my parents also got divorced, and I think that was a big stress in my life. So all those things together, I think, probably contributed to my weight gain. And then also, I think as a teenager is when you start noticing those kind of things. You become like more in tune to your body and comparing it to everyone else's and thinking about how you look, mostly become a little bit more vain in the teen years. I probably started then and dieted as early as then. I mean, I did Weight Watchers in high school, kind of like 9th, 10th grade, like that. Did mostly calorie restriction and all that yo-yo dieting and stuff. During that time, I think it was difficult because my mom, who I love dearly and I'm very, very close to and is one of my best friends, has always put a lot of pressure on me, I would say, when it comes to my weight. So my mom also had been a little overweight and wanted to lose weight, but sort of never to the degree that I was. And she always put a lot of pressure and said, oh, you know, you want to do it while you're young and you don't want to have that and you want to do this. And I always felt like I was even more overweight than her. So if she felt that way about herself, she must feel, you know, some even more exaggerated way about how I look and what I weigh and those kind of things. So I think that kind of, she, you know, she was doing it in what she thought was a helpful way. And I've learned since to think, you know, like, just like her, if I had a child who had weight struggles, I would want to try to help them avoid it as early as possible. But I think that actually contributed a lot to my own feelings about my weight and my self-esteem and things like that.
Very difficult balance for a parent, isn't it?
To
figure out what to do for the best.
It is. It's something that I think about a lot now, you know, when even my 4-year-old talks about food and what's healthy and things like that. You know, I always try to be very cognizant of not relating it to weight and how you look, but what's healthy for your body and what's not and things like that. But it is. And I know it was like not intentional, and I know it was just all coming from a place of love and support, but I made it mean a lot to myself. So I think that didn't help with my weight struggles as a teenager. And then, so I kind of like yo-yoed up and down, nothing really significant when I was a teenager in terms of weight loss, and then went off to college. And obviously that's a recipe for worsening weight problems and weight gain. And I did a lot of yo-yo dieting in college. I remember going to our kind of gym exercise facility on campus, and my roommates and I, again, doing calorie counting and all those kind of things, and would go up a few, down a few, but mostly upwards. And then after college, I got a master's degree in biomedical science before I went to med school. And during that year, I did a diet with my mom. We did this kind of crazy, like, acupressure-based thing where we had these little, like, beads behind our ears that we would rub every few hours. So crazy stuff. And basically, it was a very, very calorie-restricted diet. It was like, for 2 days in a row, you would have 20 ounces of milk a day. That's it. And then for 2 days in a row, you would have 1.5 pounds of vegetables and 2 fruits. And that's it. And you just went back, forth, back, forth. And, you know, I lost about 120 pounds in like 8 months doing that diet.
Wow. You managed to sustain that for 8 months. That's quite impressive.
That's the real miracle part. Like, I look back now and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what was I doing to myself, and how dangerous is that for your body? But, you know, at the time you're like, this is working for me. This is great. I can keep going. And My mom and some of our family friends had initially started it with us, but they, after a few weeks, were like, this is crazy. I can't do this. But we did it for that whole time. And I felt really good about how I looked and whatever. And I remember a lot of people around me being like, you're so different. Like, you change so much. Your personality, you're not so fun and whatever. And me just being like, out there, jealous, whatever. But I'm sure I was just like crabby, nasty B word because I was starving. So then, you know, at the end of that, we were still kind of going, and we went on a vacation and started, like, you know, cheating a little bit more, and then that just goes off the rails. So, and then once, I think when you're on something so crazy restrictive, when you start eating normally again, it's so, so hard to go back to. So I never really ended up, I tried going back here and there, and then I kind of like abandoned it, and my weight slowly crept back up through the first like couple of years of med school, which were after that, which was hard. And med school was obviously very busy and stressful and whatever, and that added a lot of stress for me. So I ended up gaining the majority of that back. I went to med school. I decided to become a pediatrician. I started my pediatrics residency at Columbia, New York, and which was a very busy residency training program. So again, my weight, I think, probably took a little bit of a backseat in terms of doing something about it, but always was in like the forefront of my mind. Obviously, like becoming a doctor, I'm like, you're supposed to be a role model for your patients. Like, you're teaching children about their health. Like, what are you thinking? You need to get control of your weight, you know? So it was a lot of that kind of negative self-image and all of that. And then I had my first child in residency. I actually was really careful during my pregnancy with her. I gained like very little weight because I had plenty already to lose. I gained maybe like, I think, less than 10 pounds when I was pregnant with her. So when I went home, I was like lower than my pre-pregnancy weight, like as soon as I got home from the hospital after having her. And I was like, okay, this is good, you know. And then I was breastfeeding her, and she had milk and soy protein intolerance, and I was very dedicated to breastfeeding. So I decided to cut all dairy and soy out of my diet, which is the majority of all food. Certainly almost all processed foods, as you know, have like soy products and things in them. And then dairy, you know, I would like sit there breastfeeding her and say, I would only give up cheese for you. But I did that for about 7 or 8 months. And that kind of like naturally just, I think, helped me control my eating because I couldn't really eat anything processed or anything that was bad for you. So I lost weight doing that and breastfeeding with her. So that was good. And then I stopped breastfeeding her, and slowly my weight crept back up. Between my kids, I did paleo for a few months. I did Whole30s, things like that. And I liked that, and those worked for me. And then I got pregnant with my second daughter. So I started a little bit lower weight, and then I gained more weight with her pregnancy. So I ended up around the same place I was at the end of my first pregnancy. And then when I had her, I breastfed also, and she had no dietary issues. So, and I had a lot of worries about my milk supply because with my first one, I had trouble sustaining, I think, being back as a resident and busy at work and all of those things. I couldn't really keep up with her needs. So I ended up weaning her a little earlier than I wanted to. So with the second one, I was worried about my milk supply, and I was like, got to make sure I eat, keep up the calories for the milk supply, all that kind of stuff. So I ended up, you know, gaining back almost everything that I had lost. So that brings me to when my second child was about 11 months old, which was last November. I was, you know, getting toward finishing up my pediatric critical care fellowship. And one of my attendings was like, losing weight, looking great. And I'm like, what are you doing? And she's like, oh, it's this thing. It's like low carb, high fat, and like intermittent fasting. And I'm like, high fat? Like, what is she talking about? That's crazy, you know? But she's like, no, it's so great. And she's like, look, I'm eating cheese, like all this stuff. And she's like, you should try it. So then in November, I was like, okay, I'll start like looking into it. She hooked me up with a Facebook group. There's like a women physicians weigh in Facebook group, the majority of which do some iteration of a low-carb diet. I mean, people do whatever they want, but the majority are doing some kind of low-carb and whatever. So I started looking at that, and that was November. December was like the month that my house was ravaged with stomach bugs. So that gave us all a little jump start. And then in January, I kind of committed and decided to get going with low carb, high fat intermittent fasting, which in learning more about it, I figured out was actually keto, which she didn't call it. But I started restricting to, you know, less than 20 grams of net carbs a day and eating in an 8-hour window. And, you know, I read the obesity code and then read like the Big Fat Surprise and a lot of the research that I would read about or hear on. I started listening to Keto Dudes podcast and read some of that research. And I was just like, how did I never know about this? Like, why, you know, I'm a doctor. I went through medical training. You get very little nutrition, teaching in medical training, as everyone knows. But I'm like, hormonal theory of weight loss. This makes so much sense. Like, it's just mind baffling to me that I never knew about this. And like, as you know, I'm an intensivist. So at the heart of what we do, we are physiologists. Like what our job is to know on a very basic level how the body works and what's going on with it, what's deranged, so that we can intervene and fix it and change what's going on. And it was just, it all just clicked for me. And everything, every decision that I made after that kind of, I would relate back to those theories that I read about and just go from there. And it's been really life changing for me, I'd say. I mean, I can't say anything. I'm only about 8 months into it, but it's unlike any other program that I've ever been on because I don't feel like I'm doing that, like white knuckling through, like, oh, you just got to make it to your goal. You just got to make it to your goal. And I don't ever, I always say on every other diet that I've been on, it's always like the looking forward to the next cheat day, you know, like when's the next holiday? When's the birthday? When am I next going to have like something good? When am I going to quote unquote cheat? Whatever. And since I started 8 months ago, I've never had a cheat day. I never feel like the need to quote unquote cheat because I'm not hungry. I'm very satisfied and I feel great. So I've lost about 80 pounds since I started. And I have a little bit more to go, but yeah, it's been life changing for me in the weight loss, but just in so many other ways. Like during this time, I've also started picking up some podcasts and teachings and stuff about all mind work and things like that. And that's something that I never really thought about or did when I did any other weight loss programs. And, you know, I've always been like a crazy type A person, but things outside of weight loss have changed. I'm much more organized, much more neat, I try to work on other things. We were talking earlier about sleep and things like that. So I find that it's just kind of turned a lot of things around for me.
You're absolutely right in talking about, and a lot of people say that with keto, that it's a lifestyle choice, it's a way of eating that we embrace for the long term, even though some people bang on about the fact that it can only be done short term and it's going to kill you if you do it long term, but we all know that's not true. It
drives me crazy when people are like, oh, a fad diet like keto. I'm like, okay, exactly. You mean like people ate back in the day when there wasn't processed food and wheat and grains and all that? Okay, sure.
That's right. And like you say, it's the difference between white knuckling on a diet that is basically not enjoyable at all and quite often really hideous, and jumping between these islands of these sort of cheat respites.
Totally.
That you just spend all your time looking forward to. And of course the danger is, and I'm sure we've all done it, that one of those respite islands becomes the norm again.
Right.
And all that work that you've put in white knuckling it just goes out the window because you can't face going back to it. So
totally. And like, you're like, you have one cheat day, so it's like, okay, well, you know, for breakfast I'll have like my favorite, you know, bagel and all this stuff, and then for lunch, and then it's like, oh, but I can't fit it all into that day, so maybe it'll just be the weekend. And then before you know it, it's snowballing out of control. So
Exactly. And I find often with people, well, I mean, certainly with myself, to use as an example, if I do go off plan because maybe I'm away and eating with family or don't want to make a fuss or whatever it is, whatever the reason is, I end up feeling so awful that it is just a blessed relief to go back to keto.
Right.
You know, so it is so enjoyable, it's a lovely way to eat. But the other thing I was going to pick up on with you was this weird imbalance that seems to exist with this lack of nutritional training for people at medical school, because it seems to me that every person who has had that kind of training, who finds out about keto, usually for themselves, it automatically resonates with them because, of course, they have all that biochemistry knowledge. So as soon as they start reading the science, they know exactly, you know, what you're talking about, what this stuff is that they're reading. It makes complete sense.
Yeah, definitely.
So it just seems crazy that there isn't more of that information given in medical school when we see what a massive difference it can make to people's health. I was going to ask you, in your work, how much are you finding issues with the children that you care for and see? How much of that is diet related?
In my work is a little different because it's so subspecialized that I just see like the most critically ill of children. So right. I think I'm a little further removed than like a primary care pediatrician or a generalist, even like an adult, family practice or, adult, internist would be from seeing that. But certainly we all know that like obesity is a huge rampant problem and is starting earlier and earlier and affecting our kids greatly. So I think the fact that we don't get that kind of nutrition training in med school, I mean, I don't even remember what nutrition training we got. It might have been like a day worth of lectures in a 2-year period, really, because I don't remember what it was. And like you said, when we hear about this, it's like, you know, I give a lot of people credit who, you know, don't have that biochemistry background and like really read and work to understand this, because I understand like the fundamentals of those biochemical pathways and things like that from my training. And I'm like, oh, this is crazy. It makes sense. And I'm like, these people who have never like studied science and things like that, like they really get it. And it's awesome. But back to, you know, how it's affecting kids. I mean, I think it's hard because we still are hearing things like we don't know how ketones affect the developing brain, and, you know, we don't know if it's safe for example, pregnant women to do keto or breastfeeding mothers to do keto, because we don't know what the effects of ketones will be on children. So in terms of keto specifically, I think that's still difficult, but certainly there's plenty of evidence to support a ketogenic diet in adults, especially adults with kind of metabolic derangements like type 2 diabetes and PCOS and things like that and other forms of insulin resistance. I first encountered a ketogenic diet and heard of a ketogenic diet when talking about kids with seizures. So it seems to me that kids with what we'd say refractory seizures, or seizures that haven't been responding to often multiple like anticonvulsant medications, are the kids that end up on a ketogenic diet, and many of them do have good success with it. And then in terms of applying it in my daily practice, you know, I try to spread the word about keto as much as I can, because I truly think it's very life changing. So even I find, to me, sharing what I've been doing with other healthcare professionals, whether it be my colleagues in other subspecialties or nurses or anyone, at least, you know, if I talk about it, hopefully they'll either try it or talk about it and people will get to learn about it. And then recently, you know, we see a lot of kids with diabetic ketoacidosis in the pediatric ICU. So that's where, you know, our sugar derangements usually are. We don't have a lot of type 2 diabetics in pediatrics, but we have a lot of type 1s. And mm-hmm. we see kids who have first been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and a lot of kids who either have uncontrolled type 1 diabetes or are non-compliant with their insulin regimens and things like that. And I have started telling parents, like, you know, you're going to meet with a diabetes educator and you're going to meet with a diabetes nutritionist and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, you know, they'll give you what the standard recommendations are, but I'm like, there's also a thing called a ketogenic diet that you might want to take a look at, because some people do have success with it, and some type 1 diabetics find that they need to use less insulin. And, you know, I can't say this is what I recommend and you have to do it, because that's just not the reality of our medical system right now. But, and unfortunately, I know that the diabetes educators are going to tell them to eat hundreds and hundreds of grams of carbs a day or whatever it may be. But I find, you know, if a few parents Google it and look up ketogenic diet and type 1 diabetes and one of them tries it, that's something. So.
Exactly. And there's that great Facebook group, isn't there? The Type 1 Grit, which really is a sizable group now and has lots of fantastic information. And they're doing a lot of research as well, I believe.
Yeah, that's good. That can only help.
Exactly. It seems sensible to me to keep your blood sugar as stable as possible if you're a type 1. I mean, I know you're never going to be in the position where you don't need to take any insulin at all, because that's just the way it works. But
right.
To be able to reduce how much you need to take and reduce those peaks and troughs must be a good thing.
Well, yeah, the dangers are what we're talking about, and the peaks and troughs, right? So if they get very hyperglycemic, they can go into DKA or diabetic ketoacidosis, which is a very dangerous condition, which uneducated people are like, you can't do a keto diet, you get DKA. Like, no, you won't, because you're not diabetic and you have basal insulin levels, but that's another point. And then the other dangerous point is hypoglycemia. So when you have to treat hyperglycemia with a lot of insulin, then you drop your blood sugar and you can get hypoglycemic. So, and that can come with seizures and like coma and neurologic changes. So I believe if you could keep your blood sugar around a stable level, and so obviously you're still going to need to inject some basal long-acting insulin, which is what our bodies without type 1 diabetes do on their own. But then if you can, you know, limit it to just smaller boluses of insulin throughout the day if you need it, then you're at less risk of developing that hypoglycemia.
Mm-hmm. Which, like you say, yeah, that's where the dangers are in those extremes. So keeping it as flatline as possible is a good idea. You mentioned about your weight going up and down and the different diets you did. What impact did that have on your health? Because I should imagine, especially that long period where you were on very, very low calorie, that must have started having some repercussions on your health, surely.
Yeah, I think one thing that maybe spared me was my age, because I think I was hopefully young enough that I didn't develop such metabolic derangements as someone who did that in older age might. I do remember, especially when I lost all that weight on, you know, the quote unquote crazy diet, I remember just feeling like cold all the time, hair loss, things like that, dry skin. So I would almost guarantee I had an issue with my thyroid. I never got it checked, but, and then sure that my metabolic rate suffered from years and years of yo-yo dieting, which probably made things a little bit more difficult kind of starting out with keto. But luckily I have not had any evidence of kind of metabolic derangements like insulin resistance and things like that.
Well, all those symptoms you were talking about feeling cold and hair loss and things like that, I mean, that's your metabolism slowing down, isn't it?
Right.
To try and keep up with this starvation diet you're putting it on. It's just,
yeah.
Well, I'll shut down the non-essential things then.
I really don't want to even know what my basal metabolic rate was at the end of that 8 months. I'm sure it was not good. Hence why, as soon as I started eating, quote unquote, normally again, I regained my weight very rapidly, which also is not good.
Yeah, so hopefully this period of time you've been on keto, like you say, for quite a while now, 8 months, it's given your body a chance to heal itself and find its new norms.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, you talked about the importance of mind work and these and other things you started investigating since keto. Tell us a bit more about that.
So mostly at the recommendation of that Facebook group that I was talking about, I discovered a few different podcasts that are done by life coaches and things like that, which, you know, before this, I would have thought that, you know, life coach, what is that? That's like a woo-woo, whatever thing. But I started listening to some things, and the things that they talked about just like really made sense. And I started thinking to myself, like, what is going to make this different than any other plan or way of eating that I've been on? Like, what, yes, keto, I do find inherently is more sustainable, and because of the physical changes and lack of hunger and things like that, I do think it's different. But I think you have to also be different if you're going to sustain any major life change, whether it be the way you eat, you know, and the way you, you know, operate in a lot of different ways in your life. So I think finding those things, people talk about, oh, the most important things are like diet, exercise, and mindfulness. And everyone throws out mindfulness, mindfulness. But like, what does that actually mean? Like, what do you have to do to be mindful? So I think what the bottom line is that it needs to be an individualized thing, and you need to figure out what you need to learn about yourself and sort of the things that you can do to be mindful. For me, some things that have been helpful is starting out just talking about like the real kind of fundamental reasons why you want to lose weight. And everyone will say, oh, you know, I want to fit in a size 4, or I want to look a certain way, or I want to go to this wedding and wear this dress or whatever. But that's not a real reason. You want to look thin, great. But there has to be a deeper seated motivation for why you want to lose weight. So for me, I would say, you know, being an example for my children, I have 2 young girls. I already talked about the struggles that I had, with my mother and, my weight as a teenager and things like that. Being an example for them and also for patients, you know, I became a doctor to help people and make children healthier, and I think it's important to put that forward. And then what weight loss brings with it. So I wanted to lose weight to be able to be confident and really like to be who I believe I truly am. I feel in the past that my weight held me back and made me unable to kind of express who I truly was, made me hesitant to kind of put myself out there, even in my work, my personal life, express my opinions, things like that, because it was always in the back of my mind, like, oh, what are they thinking of me? Like, you know, I always had that kind of negative self-image and, you know, thinking that other people were judging me for what I looked like and thinking that I was lazy or unmotivated or things like that. So I think that that's getting to the core of why you really want to lose weight, apart from the vanity kind of external issues, is important. And then again, talking about like the negative self-talk, like you talking negatively about yourself is a basically prescription for yourself to perform poorly. So if you say, you know, I always do a bad job on the weekends, or like when I go away, I always overeat, or I binge eat at nighttime when my kids go to bed, or I would, okay. Well, if you keep saying that, that's what you're going to keep doing. So maybe you need to stop saying that. And I think starting to say, well, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to binge eat at nighttime because, you know, I make promises to myself and I keep them, helps you build a trusting relationship with yourself. Because if you tell yourself you're going to do something and you don't, every time you do that, you're kind of breaking trust. So I think those are things that I've learned that have been really important. Sort of having a little list of like mantras you tell yourself. So things that I've learned on various podcasts, and we can cite them in the show notes or whatever you want to do. Some things that I recite to myself often are what I just said. I make promises to myself that I keep. So if I have a thought like, oh, it would be really good to have that, whatever it may be, I say, no, I'm not going to have that because I make promises to myself that I keep. And I say, you know, I can do hard things. I'm like, I'm a doctor. I went to med school. I achieved a lot. And, you know, part of that is that has added to this whole struggle. Like, how come I can go to med school and get really good grades and, get into a residency that's highly competitive and I really want and do all these things, but I can't do this for myself. So I tell myself I can do hard things. I make promises to myself that I keep, things like that. And then talking about practice, that's a concept that I heard a lot about and makes so much sense to me. And it's like, every time you do something, consider it like practice. So, you know, someone used an example once that, like, if you go to a restaurant and you pass up on the bread the first time, like, that's really hard. And you're like, oh, I really want to eat that bread, but I'm not going to do it because I know it's not good for me. And I make promises to myself I keep, whatever. But the 27th time you do that, it is a non-issue. You've practiced plenty of times and it's like, here you go. Or, you know, if you go away for the weekend with your friends and like the first time you're like, oh, I'm just going to have one drink this time, like instead of 10, whatever. You know, the first time you're like, maybe I should have another drink. I don't know. And it's all this chatter in your head, chatter, chatter. And this, the 17th time you're like, no, that's what I do. I go, I have one drink, I enjoy myself and we have fun anyway. So I think that's been an important concept as well. And then in terms of like your focus, just thinking about what's an improvement for you. You know, if you're already going out and like running a mile every day, okay, adding like a quarter mile might not be an improvement for you. But if you're completely sedentary and you do nothing, just getting up and doing chores around your house or going and doing a walk around the block might be a huge improvement. So I think that comes down to not comparing yourself to others. You hear about other people's journeys. You're like, oh, that girl lost a lot of weight because she does whatever it might be. She does one meal a day, or she does intermittent fasting like this, or she, you know, keeps it to 15 net carbs or 30 or whatever. Like, that's not you. So stay in your lane and find what works for you, because it's different for everyone. So focus on your biggest problems, focus on what's an improvement for you, and do that. And I think there's been a whole new perspective that I've gained about quitting, because in the past, when I've quote unquote cheated or quit or whatever, things kind of go off the rails. And I think that happens sometimes because we think our progress isn't fast enough. And you're like, ugh, this stinks, and like I only lost 2 pounds this month and I'm going crazy and I don't like it, and I'm just gonna go back to eating the way I was, or who cares, whatever. But like, if you stop and think about that, that makes no sense. So you're not making progress fast enough. So your answer to that is, let's not make any progress at all, or let's make progress in the other direction and gain it back. It's just asinine. But like, our brain plays all these tricks on us. It's like, well, you know, you really wanted to lose this much and you didn't, so you should eat that cookie. That cookie looks pretty good. You want that cookie? And it's like, okay, no, that doesn't make any sense. So it's just like really stopping and thinking about the way that your mind is trying to tell you to do things that you really don't want to do, and making promises to yourself and building a trusting relationship with yourself, I think, is really important. In terms of kind of daily practice of those things, a big thing that I've done is planning ahead, which I know can be difficult for people. But for me, in my life and how crazy I can be, my schedule changes and it can be hectic with the kids and stuff, I find it very helpful to kind of plan my week or most of it ahead of time. Log what I'm going to eat, make my shopping list, do my food prep, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, that's a concept I heard about. This one life coach calls decisions ahead of time. So you make your decision and then you stick to it, because you make promises to yourself that you keep. And we're going back in a circle, but that's exactly, and that just works for me. And I think keto has been a very good fit with this, because it's not, oh, I'm white knuckling, but I make promises to myself that I keep. It's like, no, I'm enjoying the way I eat. I feel really good. Happy with my progress. I'm satisfied. And also, I make promises to myself that I keep. So,
yes, I like that. I like that overall practice. And like you say, the repetition, being mindful at first of just what's going on and unpacking your emotional connection to food and different habits, and then starting to form new habits. And I was discussing this with a guest a couple of weeks ago, who was saying that you can form these new neural pathways, these new habits. And as you were saying, it is very difficult the first few times you do it, but once it becomes a habit, and especially if that habit is starting to make you feel good, where the thing with those old habits is you kept doing them thinking they were going to bring you some kind of comfort, but actually they don't make you feel good.
Exactly.
So if you start with these new habits that start making you feel good, they're going to be much easier to keep reinforcing, like you say, with your mantras or anything that works for you. And I particularly like what you said about not comparing with other people, because that's, and again, this is with last week's guest was talking about this with her top tip, but it's very difficult when you set a standard with something that has nothing to do with you. So like you say, if you have a very sedentary lifestyle, just getting up and going for a short walk or doing some chores or just being a little bit more active is a massive improvement for you and something that you should feel very, very proud of. But what we quite often tend to do is, well, there's this person that's doing really well, who's lost a lot of weight and she's running a mile every day. Right. I should be doing that. And if I'm not doing it to that extent, then I'm a big old failure. But of course you're not. And you can never compare yourself to somebody else. So yes, I like that. I like that practice and the fact that you build on it as you go and you tweak it and you adjust it and you individualize it. I think that's what's so important for keto and for mindfulness and for all sorts of things is tailoring it to you.
Yeah. Like personally, I think social media can be a great tool and I like it. I think it's a great support and there are people out there that are available to help you if you're having an issue and provide support and things like that. But, you know, I think that's where the danger comes in with the comparing and that people read these stories and they're like, I have to do exactly what that girl did. And it's like, no, you don't, because that's not your life. And your work is different. Your schedule is different. Your body is different. The way you respond to certain foods or whatever is different. So, you know, find what works for you. If you think, she's doing that and that sounds like something I could do and that would make my plan sustainable for me, great. Like, if you want to try it, great. But also, if it doesn't work, like, it's not set in stone. You know, that didn't work for you. Okay, move on. Find something that does. So I think that's an important way to approach these kind of Facebook groups and Instagram and all that kind of stuff is saying, like, oh, I'm going to look at this and use this as support, but I'm going to find what works for me.
Exactly. It's just support and inspiration that you can cherry pick and make your own plan. And talking about that, I mean, what does your day-to-day keto look like? Because you've obviously got a very, very busy lifestyle. So you already mentioned that you do quite a lot of planning and prep work probably on days when you do have a bit of time. So that, and I know that helps so many people that if you've got something sitting there ready in the fridge for that day when you come back exhausted and, you know, those old habits are gnawing away in the back of your mind saying, oh, have something carby because that's what you need. If you've yeah. got something there ready that's quick and easy, you can bung in the microwave or just eat straight out the fridge. That really helps, doesn't it? So, but what do you do? Tell me a bit about your day to day.
Yeah, I find planning ahead is important for me. One, because I'm busy and I need to like have what I need ready, but also because deciding ahead of time what I'm going to have. And obviously, you know, if I know I'm going out on the next Friday night or something, I don't say like, oh, I'm going to that restaurant. I'm definitely going to have it. It's not like so rigid, but deciding what I'm going to have and doing my prep and stuff ahead also takes that like food chatter out of your brain. So it's not like every day, ooh, what am I going to have? Maybe I could have this. Oh, maybe I could have that. Oh, maybe I could think this. Oh, maybe I could like watch a TV show and like see what they're making. And maybe I could look at this recipe. Like, no, you already decided what you're going to have. That's it. Simple. Done. And it's not saying that it's going to be boring or anything like that because everything that you make is great and delicious, but you already made a decision so you don't have to think about it all day. And it's just one less thing to do. For me personally, I know they say about 10% of women like don't have that satiety signal thing. I honestly think that I could be within that. If I'm truthful with myself, I don't think that I ever really feel very hungry. Even back when I was like very obese and eating a ton and whatever, I can't even remember if I actually felt truly hungry. And on the same note, unless I'm like stuffed to the rafters full, I really don't often feel like very full. So I know a lot of keto is that a lot of people can practice that like intuitive eating and eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. For me personally, I'm not sure that I have that. Maybe I do, and maybe it will, I'll hone it over time and I try to stop and say, am I hungry right now? But like, I'm not sure. So for me, I personally do track my food and I do monitor my calories. That being said, I don't calorie restrict to the point that I ever did before. In fact, I did a little trial for a month, like back in June. I was like, oh, I'll bring down, I had lost weight and my little tracker was saying like, try this many calories. So I dropped it a little bit and I actually like lost much less weight that month. I went back to higher calories and I lost more. So I definitely don't do it in a way that's like restricting calories like you would on other classic calories in, calories out kind of dieting. But I do track and try to stay within a certain range and I try to monitor myself from there and I keep track of my like net carbs and things like that. So my day-to-day keto is really, I would say, very simple. So I, like I said, I do 16-8 intermittent fasting. I've done since I started. When I talk to people now who are thinking about starting, I tell them that's probably not a good idea until they're fat adapted and they'll feel better. But I just started because that's what, you know, my attending was like, try this. And I'm like, okay. So I started from the beginning and then I've added some other fasting. So it's kind of changed throughout. I've done some like longer extended fasts up to like 5 days, but more recently I've had a lot of success with alternate day fasting. So I read about it in the Obesity Code. I've heard Jason Fung and Megan Ramos talk about it. So I decided to try that. So usually a couple of days a week, I kind of do 40 or so hour fast, and that works well for me. So days that I eat, I have two meals. My lunch is usually something easy that I can have at work, like some greens and protein, maybe some cheese, like usually salad or something like that. And then at dinner, I have meat, veggies, and usually some source of fat, some avocado or macadamia nuts or something like that. In terms of like replacements, I did it more with the like keto carb kind of replacements in the beginning and treats and stuff like that. Now I find I try to limit myself and I have quote unquote keto treats or things that have like artificial sweetener and things like that, only on the weekend. So I like will allow myself a treat on a Saturday and a treat on a Sunday. And that's about it because I'm the type of person that, you know, it will get out of control and I don't want to be eating all that artificial sweetener and stuff. So that works for me. I think honestly, it's just a matter that is sustainable for me. So, it's just a matter of finding what works for you and what's sustainable. In general, like, you know, I think I've heard you talk about this, like food having, you know, all its addictive properties. I think that food definitely is addictive, especially sugars and stuff like that. So I do try to limit that like sweet flavor because I think that can be kind of a initiating event for a big snowball effect. And I have family history of addiction. So my dad had issues with drug addiction, my brother as well. So, you know, my mom and her quote unquote helpful way has always said like, you know, that's their addiction. Our addiction is food. And I'm like, yeah, thanks mom. You know, not that helpful, but okay. So that's why for me, certain things like moderation, you know, probably won't work. So I know that I need to be a little bit more strict and limit myself and kind of have my own set of rules because I've always been a rule follower. Like I said, I'm very type A. So I make rules for myself that work for me and make things sustainable. So that's what works for me.
It's interesting what you were saying about the satiety concept in it, because it's a term that gets bandied around a lot, doesn't it? You know, eat to satiety, eat fat to satiety. We hear that a lot. And how with a number of people, that works really well for them. And they do literally get to a point, you know, I don't want to eat anymore. But for people, I think you have more of an emotional attachment to food. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. You know, someone says to you, we'll just eat to satiety. And I know certainly that eating keto has helped tune me in a bit more to that.
Definitely.
But I certainly suffer from head hunger a lot, which has nothing to do with physical satiety. And interesting what you were saying about not sort of ever really being particularly hungry or feeling particularly full. And that's something I used to feel back when I was morbidly obese. And yes, never really feeling one or the other. I'd be interested to know, when you said that you've been doing some fasting and extended fasting, do you find that that brings those signals into tune a bit more? Because I certainly feel that when I fast, I can't fast for particularly long, but if I do a day or two, it does give me a bit of clarity with that difference between what's head hunger and what's real stomach growling hunger. Have you not found when you fast that you get a sense of what real hunger is?
Yes, I definitely think that fasting helps to kind of hone those things. I also think if someone would have told me 8 months ago, like, you're not going to eat for an entire day, I would have said, you're crazy. There is no way that's going to happen. But I think particularly the lack of hunger during fasting has helped clarify for me, like, what actual hunger does feel like. What's funny is, obviously, I told you I'm a planner, so I always know how long I'm going to fast, so I know when the end of my fast is coming. Even in the couple hours leading up to when I'm planning to eat, I start feeling like, oh, I'm getting really hungry. And then I'm like, Amy, are you actually hungry? I'm like, you weren't hungry an hour ago. You weren't hungry last night, and it had been 2 days since you ate. Are you sure you're actually hungry? And then I'll be like, maybe I'm not hungry. And also this notion that hunger is a transient emotion. It's like, you might actually feel hungry while you're fasting, but then you might drink a big glass of water, have some salt, and an hour later, you don't feel hungry at all. So, you know, that whole, like, I could never do that because I'd be so hungry. It's like, hunger's not going to kill you, and it's also not permanent, so you will stop feeling hungry. But yeah, I do think there have been times that I'm like, no, like, my stomach's actually growling. Like, I am actually hungry, and in addition to wanting to eat right now, I think I am actually hungry. And then after a fast, I find when you first eat, you do feel more full. I think because you were completely, like, empty. So that first meal, even I try to eat, like, a light meal after I have a little bit longer fast, I'll be like, wow, I'm really, at least, even if it's not full, I'm really, like, satisfied by that. When I'm on a normal, like, eating streak, you know, two times a day for several days, I would be like, what, that little salad? That won't fill me up, you know? But I do think that that helps with those signals. I also find that sometimes it's like, once I start eating, I want to keep eating, whereas if I was fasting, it wouldn't bother me. Like, if I am home all day and I'm not particularly busy, I'll have my lunch and it's, you know, perfectly fine, satisfying, whatever. And then I'm like, when's dinner? And I'm like, why are you thinking about dinner? Like, you just finished your lunch. But that just proves to me that it's not a whole, like, hunger and satiety or fullness thing. It's just a, what'd you say, mind hunger? It's like a...
Yeah, it's a head hunger. Yes, and I certainly call it a sort of snack monster thing. I mean, I certainly think about food a lot more when I'm at home. You know, I can be out all day working and have had the same breakfast that I have, you know, when I'm at home. And I don't think about eating when I'm busy doing something else all day. But if I'm at home and I'm near the fridge, I'll definitely start thinking, oh, yeah, I'm feeling a bit hungry. And like you say, I'm not actually in need of food. I'm right. Just feeling snacky hungry.
Right. Yeah, I find even on my, like, 24-hour work shift, sometimes is when I'll plan, like, to do my fast. And I'm so busy that the whole day will go by and it'll be 10 p.m. or something. And I'm like, oh, I fasted today. Whoops. Like, or like, I didn't even think about it. And then I'm like, that's good. And I never once felt like hungry, need anything. Like, so it's much easier when you're busy, for sure.
Yes. And a lot of people find that fasting really helps get their mind active, and you know, they perform a lot better in that respect when they're fasting. Mm-hmm. I know Richard Morris, one of the dudes, always talks about when he's got an exam, he always goes into that fasted because he knows he's going to do better. So I think maybe for some people it does help with their work. If you've got a long shift, that can really help.
Yeah, I think it definitely gives you, I think keto in general, I have felt like incredible, like, mental clarity and ability to focus that, you know, obviously I could focus. I went through med school and everything, but it's so far beyond what I've ever been able to do. And when I fast, yeah, I just feel like I'm very like focused, task oriented. I'm not as easily distracted. I sometimes find when I fast, I actually like have difficulty going to sleep because I have so much energy, which is crazy. I'm like, how come when you don't eat, you have more energy, you know, but it's true because you're using your own body fat for energy. And that's an excellent source of energy, apparently, because I don't want to go to sleep at night. But
yes, it definitely is. I struggle very much if I'm fasting to get to sleep at night. It's a tricky one. I can't get my brain to switch off at all.
Yeah. And sometimes you're like, okay, my fast is over tomorrow. I just want to go to sleep so I can wake up and my fast will be over, but then you can't go to sleep, but whatever, it's good.
Exactly. Yes. It's a good way to get through another block of time when you're fasting, isn't it? To add a sleep.
Yes. Yes.
Well, knowing what a planner you are, I'm sure you've planned a top tip for us to end the show. What's your top tip?
I thought about several different, but as I've gone through this, I think my top tip that's been the most helpful for me is really learn what your true motivations are for weight loss or improving your health, and then make your own rules, which focus on what is an improvement for you and what is sustainable for you. Because the bottom line is that's what's going to bring you success. So I think that that's just individualizing things and learning more about yourself and how to keep this going.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today. I hope you have a nice restful sleep after your long 24-hour shift.
Yeah, we'll see. I've been fasting, so hopefully I'll be able to sleep.
Uh-oh. Might not be so easy. Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. It's thanks to the two keto dudes that I'm hosting this podcast. So please consider heading to their Patreon page at patreon.2keto.com and help them bring you more podcasts like this one. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on iTunes and Facebook. Every star and review really does help. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's quote is from Louise Hay. I do not fix problems. I fix my thinking, then the problems fix themselves. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.